This recording is produced from Open Reel Tapes, originally recorded for Vancouver Community College, Langara Campus, in 1970. This program forms part of the Langara College Reel History Project, which restores and preserves British Columbia's oral history. This project is funded in part by the British Columbia 2000 Millennium Arts and Heritage Fund, in partnership with Vancouver Public Library and Langara College. Copyright for this product is held by Langara College. It may not be reproduced in whole or in part in any form without permission from the copyright holder. The title of this recording is The Role of the MLA, New Democratic Party Members Dennis Cock and Ernest Hall. The interviewers are members of the Vancouver Community College faculty. The interviewees are Dennis Cock and Ernest Hall. The audience consists of students at Vancouver Community College, Langara Campus.
We are presenting two New Democratic members, Mr. E. Hall from Surrey and Mr. D. Cokes from New Westminster. Mr. Cokes, what was your educational background?
High school in the Prairie.
Mr. Hall,
I'm trying to teach you.
What university do you train at?
Not a university, the training college.
Whereabouts in England?
Northern England. I attended grammar schools and then Salford Royal Technical College and teaching training college in the northwest of England.
Who or what, Mr. Coke, who or what early influence, well, I'll start that again. Who or what influenced your early political thinking?
Well, I joined the Air Force when I was 18 years old, and I saw the irrelevancy of war at that time, and at least in my view it was, and I came out apolitical. But I married the daughter of an old socialist from the Prairie, who had done a tremendous amount of reading. He just died, as a matter of fact, 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago. And I had a tremendous respect for him. And as I say, I was married at 22, and at 22 and a half, I had a fair library presented to me and the encouragement to do a little thinking for a change. And at that point, I began to make some strides in this direction.
Mr. Hall, what was the influence on you? What was your political thinking before you got into politics?
I got in with a time when I wasn't in politics. My family was a political family. My father was a member of the political party in England. And I can remember as a young boy working in elections for his election. As soon as I was able, at 15, I joined the Labour Party and ran for public office as soon as I was qualified to run for public office. And I kept that up even after I emigrated.
Mr. Coke, what particular incident, excuse me, or reason led you to the post of MLA?
What particular incident or reason was there one?
Well,
yeah, there is a reason. The reason being that I'm totally dissatisfied with the with our system, and system being I'm not dissatisfied with the basic system if in fact it were enjoyed. But I was dissatisfied with the fact that there are people in our society who have far too much going for them, and I was relatively successful in the business world. I was a manager of a large life insurance company from British Columbia and one or two other things. But I saw in the work that I was doing, now mind you, I didn't change my affiliation, nor did I change my party stand all through those years. And it became more relevant to me. The thing that really became relevant was maybe it was about time. I was 45 years of age at the time that I decided to seek a nomination for MLA. And so at that point, I just made the decision that that would be it. I was making a break, and I'd go that route because I felt it was relevant.
Mr. Hall, what particular incident or reason led you to the post of MLA?
Well, no single incident. Having been political since childhood, and my father having been elected to public office, and having attempted the same route myself in England, it's just been a natural thing for more years than I care to remember. Having emigrated to Canada, it wasn't long before I got involved again in direct political action. And having been appointed campaign manager and things like that for various people in the early 60s, I was asked to become the full-time provincial secretary of the party, which I did. And having been provincial secretary for some 3 years, it seemed to me then that was I'd become familiar enough with the Canadian scene and with the requirements that I think one should mentally check off to seek a nomination myself, which I did in 66.
Mr. Koch, since you became an MLA, has your idea of the office changed in any way?
Drastically. Almost a complete about face. You want me to give you some
you can elaborate?
Well, I can elaborate in this way, that I felt that to seek political office and to be the people's representative in the legislature was getting to where the action was. And I went over there fully expecting to be a part of the action. And once having got there, and then beginning to think about what was happening and what was going on, I felt that really wasn't where the action was by virtue of the fact that it just doesn't work that way. But at the same time, I don't have any regrets, because I do realize that I can play an important part, but I have to look at it from a different standpoint, and I can maybe enlarge upon that later.
Okay. Where do you feel that the action is then, if it's not in House of Assembly?
Yeah, well, the action is with the people. There's only one way that you can have change, and particularly with old-line parties in power, is when the people are so excited and so completely obsessed with change that the intransigent group that are in power, and don't forget, when you're in power, it's the numbers game completely. It's when the people who become either excited enough to make a change at the polls, or become excited enough to put sufficient pressure on the prevailing authority that they will change their mind about certain things. So therefore, I feel that the action gets right back to the people, and that's where the action is, whether that's greater groups, small groups, or large groups expanding. But I believe today that's my change in my own philosophy.
Yes, Mr. Coakes, I wonder if you could tell me why you chose the NDP party.
Well, in Canada, there was no other party that I could choose. The NDP represents what I consider to be the democratic process, and I also believe that socialism, and I'm talking in the terms of the broad sense of socialism, is the only answer to say future development. We've gone the route as far as the raping the resources and the profit system is concerned, and so therefore I feel that we have to now get into a situation where people are foremost and not profits, and I believe that I find that in the policy of the NDP, and I don't find it elsewhere.
Have you ever found any things that there are any policies the NDP has put forth that you don't agree with, and other parties have put forth that you do agree with?
Oh, well, there's a long scale of grays and darks and lights and so on. And yes, I feel that there are areas where all parties, we're human, aren't we? And they all have weaknesses, some have strengths. But basically, I have to go the route with the NDP, because they reflect, I believe, the needs to a greater extent than the other parties. And the NDP at this point is not mature yet, because the developing will come as the movement grows and it's growing, and as people come in and provide that yeast that's necessary to foment this type of thing.
Mr. Hall, could I ask you that same question, please? About have you ever thought about being in another party other than the NDP?
I never in the slightest bit attracted to any other party. The Conservatives, Liberals, Social Credit parties, together with some of the more orangutan offshoots of those parties, have never appealed to me because their motivations are just not my motivations. They're a status quo party. They believe in the free enterprise system, which I reject entirely. And that's not to say that we don't see from time to time legislation emanating from all my parties, but it's useless legislation. That's usually due to the pressure of the time. The original question, I thought, was had I seen within myself a change in my approach to the business of being an MLA since I became an MLA? My answer to that is no, because really, I think the question needs somewhat further elaboration. One doesn't run for office to become an MLA, and that's the end of it. One runs for office because one is seeking power for one's party. And the whole point of the exercise is to obtain power for your party, therefore to become government. Now, you're asking today two opposition MLAs to view their role. Their role is naturally circumscribed by the fact they're not government. There are two different kinds of MLAs, government and opposition. Turning to the proposition about an MLA as part of a government team, then, of course, you're really discussing one's ambitions, both personally and politically. Politically, one's ambition is to see the party one represents in power, doing the things we've been talking about, putting into operation the policies which we believe are the best for the country. Personally, one wants to make that contribution at the best possible level. I want to be a cabinet minister. That's what it's all about. So the business of in our system of being a people's representative is a peculiar amalgam of party loyalty, party discipline, party adherence, party faith, if you like, together with personal ambition, personal thoughts, conceit, if you like, that you can do a job. That's really that side of the question. Now, as far as it is being opposition, I have been in a fortunate position that I've been to any position many times before I was elected, and I know the role of an opposition MLA, which is a very difficult role. It's a role that's probably the most difficult in the House. The government backbench really has nothing to do except put its hand up at the most appropriate times. The opposition MLAs, particularly when they're smaller numbers, have in effect to shadow the efforts and pronouncements and administrative expertise of various cabinet ministers with no assistance. And the object of the exercise, in my view, is for us to become absolutely credible by knowing more about the job and the problems of your opposite number. Now, in Mr. Koch's case, he's, for this particular period of time this year, is shadowing, if you like, the efforts of one cabinet minister now shadowing the efforts of another. Mr. Koch's case is shadowing the provincial secretary. He's got to know a department that's so wide-ranging that it's almost a full-time job just finding out what that bird's doing on the other side. In my case, it's shadowing the Minister of Labour, which you can imagine this province is no small task. The other aspect of it is the question of constituent representation, and that should be true for all MLAs, whether they be backbench, government, opposition, etc. And that is, you've got to deal with the problem, both personal, physical, financial, of the people that you represent. And that means you've got to make yourself available. And you've got to deal with people who are in trouble, with workers' compensation, family courts, unemployment insurance. We get as many federal matters as the federal people. Immigration, passport applications. We get municipal matters, zoning, septic tanks, sewers, ditches, and you have to sort it all out. That kind of low-key grassroots
personal representation should be going on in all parties, and I'm sure that many government backbenchers largely attempt to do that. We have, over the years, built up a record because of the kind of people we are, and I go back in this province to people like Ernie Winch and so on. We've built up a reputation which is very difficult to maintain, a total involvement in the community, being available at all times, and being the kind of vanguard in terms of opinions and being ever ready to help. And that's almost a full-time job. And the sooner it is legitimately recognized by both government and public that it is a full-time job, the better I'll like.
Mr. Koch, I think we've got an answer here on what you do with your time in the Assembly, and what do you do with your time when you're not in the in session, we'll say?
Well, as Ernie Hall said, you spend a great deal of your time, particularly shadowing your own cabinet minister, finding out what he's doing. There are others. Naturally, we play a part in all of the portfolios, each one of us. My particular hang-up is health, besides my own cabinet minister. And as a matter of fact, I have two, but one is chance, and that doesn't mean anything. You know, I mean, public works is it's an incredible thing, but at the same time. But anyway, you do a lot of that. As Emmy said, we have to serve our constituents. I set up an office in U.S. Minster, fortunately for me, because of the fact that I'm able to do some consulting on the side because of my insurance experience for some of the trade unions that want me to look over their welfare plans with insurance and that type of thing. And it's just enough so that I can keep an office going, and I've established a place for my constituency. The third thing, and I think probably the most important contribution that I can make, will be to try to influence public opinion, and not through necessarily criticism at all times, but to try to help the public see through the continual brainwashing that goes on that there is a better way of life for them. See, most people are afraid to give up what they have for fear that they might lose what they've got, and it's incredibly little in most cases. And so that I think that my third job as an MLA is to do this kind of thing and to get as much press in and out of the House that I possibly can in order, that is, press by press, I mean either person to person or any type of media contact with people, in order to help them understand that there is another way, and it's an alternative that up to now, as you know, that they rejected, not by a great majority either, but in any event, it's there, and that's part of my job.
Mr. Hall, I'd like to ask both you and Mr. Koch this one. What do you think of the social credits program on pollution? And I didn't mean provincial-wise.
The social credit to the legislation on pollution can best be summed up as being the erection of a unifunctional licensing system. And that's all. In short, if a development takes place, industrial, or a development takes place in terms of housing, then the effluent that has to be discharged from that development is subject to possession of license. And the pollution control board, which is the only tool that the social government uses, has been set up to, in a simple, unifunctional way, to discuss that the permit, that license to pollute. There have been cases where the licenses have lapsed and nothing's been done about it. There have been cases where the permits have been ignored, discharge has been made that doesn't conform to the regulations of the firm. But there's been no overall attack on the business of pollution. There's been no research. There's very little monitoring going on. We've got a campaign about pollution, mind you, for the social credit government, which is headed up by three cabinet ministers who seem to take turns with making public announcements, Lochmar, Campbell, and Wilson. The program is insufficient, it's bureaucratic, not responsive to the problem and makes no allowances for the essential facts that pollution knows no political boundaries, and is another example of the government's proclivity to placing responsibility without the necessary financial strength of it, or any other strengths, onto all levels of government, such as the regional district and the municipalities. We've made some statements about pollution just recently, calling for a complete reversal in the government's stand. We get bogged down from time to time, all of us, in the tremendous debate on the technology of it. And yet I happen to know, my own knowledge, that people going to Sweden, looking at pulp mills, for instance, and the people in Sweden are laughing at the number of Canadians that are coming over with the pulp mills in Sweden to find out how they've done it. Because the technology is there right now, and I deny all these statements to the contrary. What's needed is simply the cabinet minister, who's got enough guts to say no, that this province is not yet ready for this development. We have not taken the view that I think is essential, and that is to work upon all developments on a social cost of council basis, that the growth for growth's sake as a principle is in my view unacceptable, that development measures simply in financial terms or rate of increase of growth in the national product is unacceptable, that development has to be measured in social as well as financial terms. We as a party have got to bring together all our development policies with it and stop using this kind of shopping list technique where we start off with A for automation and finish it with W for workers' compensation. We have to get our economic development program, our human development program, in fact, our educational program, and to tie those in with a linchpin of environmental control. The time has gone past us, and when we can compromise the environment any longer, because I don't think the environment can be compromised. But to tie all those things in, and I think that we have to come up with some financial tools to make sure that it's not profitable to produce anymore.
Mr. Koch, does the NDP have a pollution program that could be introduced?
As a matter of fact, the NDP has a pollution program that can be introduced. And this is one of the reasons, I think, that that people tend to be wary. During the last campaign, for example, Tom Berger, our leader, and I'm talking about the shopping list situation now, as Ernie Hall indicated, we also are in the process right now of developing a wide-scale integrated campaign where you include all the other aspects of living along with this and economics and so on. But for an example, when Tom Berger said that Northwood Pulp would be closed down if he became premier of the province until such time as they've met the terms of their license. And you may or may not know that they pump 90 million gallons of effluent into the Fraser every day. And that being the case, it's just contributing to the death of that river, and as are the other two mills in the area, but they're not quite as bad and so on. But these are the kinds of things that we would have to do, and we would do. We feel that we can confront industry. For one thing, we are not owned by industry. We're not financed by industry. If in fact we ever form a government, our only obligation is to the people of the province who voted for us. And that's one of the reasons why I'm a part of this team. And I think we're all over-educated on this whole matter of pollution. We really are. Most of us know